So I've got a pretty bold statement that I want to make to start our time together today, and it's one that may offend and shock some of you, but that I'm willing to do. One of the most dangerous things to have happened to Western society in the last century are Disney animated movies. Now, that's a funny statement to some of you. I hear you laughing, and some of you may be thinking, what? Are you really coming out swinging against Disney movies? Yes, I am. I am, because there is actual danger. I'm not talking about, like, some of the, you know, nefarious things that you hear about, like, The Lion King has that one scene that's like, oh, it says sex in the sky, it's dangerous. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the very concept itself of the classic Disney animated movie is an inherent danger to our society. And I stand by that. And here's why. Because what happens in a Disney movie? You know it. They're all basically the same. They just have different characters and different arcs, but they all kind of have the same general thing. You have the protagonist, typically a woman, somebody who's generally quirky, like quirky Ariel, quirky Belle, quirky Jasmine, and it's strange. I never really realized how everyone looked at them like they're weird. Like there's something weird about these protagonists that people don't understand. But the problem that they have, whether they realize it or not, whether they admit to it or not, is that something is missing in their lives. Every single one of them have something that they are missing. And it's not just their moms. That's another weird thing about Disney movies. Think back. Like, none of the main characters have a mother. That's weird, right? It's a weird thing. I don't know if Disney had a problem with his mom, but, like, that's weird. That's a weird idiosyncrasy. Like, literally, I can't think, except for Pixar movies, about, and even most Pixar movies, the moms aren't in the picture. I don't know what it is. But that's another discussion for another day. But there's something critical, something significant, something crucial that is a void in these people's lives. And that one thing, more than anything, more than validation, more than empowerment, more than self-awareness, the one thing that these characters need is love. And specifically, these young women, more than anything, need a man. Now, that sounds inconsequential on its surface, because most of these are just doctored up fairy tales. But don't allow yourself to ignore what this says to our children, what it said to me, and the lie that our society has embraced, that we are not enough. That you, on your own, are insignificant and incomplete unless you find a significant other. And it is such a way of life that we've just come to accept it as if that is the reality. As if without romance, life is just not worth living. How do Disney movies end? Whether it's explicit or implicit, the end goes something like this. And they lived happily ever after. And now, many of us, being raised in a Disneyfied culture, have come to agree and accept not merely is love important, but romance is the most important thing in life. We call it love, but what we mean is romance. When the Beatles sing that love is all you need, they're not talking about unconditional self-sacrificing love. That was not John Lennon's deal. Come on, we can agree with that. When we're talking about love means never having to say you're sorry, we're not talking about self-sacrificing love. We're talking about romance. Love is an obsession. Love, romance, is something that pop culture says is the thing that you need and that you must pursue. Until you discover it, you will be incomplete. And it's not just Disney, by the way. This isn't just something that Disney invented. He perfected it, but he did not invent it. In fact, Jane Austen, in her book Pride and Prejudice, the one before the zombie one, because that's apparently a thing now, is Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. But the opening line to that book says, "It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a what?" It's on the screen if you can read. Must be in want of a wife. That's right. I'm cultured. I've literally never read past that line. But the reality of the world that we live in is that in order to have a value, in order to be significant, we must find it in romance. We must find it in the tingly, obsessive, always catering to my needs kind of love. And even though our world has become cynical on the notion, our culture still holds romance as the greatest and noblest of pursuits. Many of us spend a significant portion of our lives hoping to find our one and only soulmate. The person who would complete me, leaving me whole, valued, pursued, and loved. And the tragedy of much in our modern world is the belief that the only meaningful way to be valued is to be in a perfect relationship that is always on the honeymoon and always has that Disney quality relationship. And that anything less than that represents a failure. And I'll be honest, it's something that the church has done nothing to help. Because I grew up in the church. I grew up in youth group and in young adult groups and college and careers groups. And there was always that sense that we were just biding our time until we found the one. And then real life would begin. I've heard sermons, I've seen movies, I've read books that all imply or explicitly state that my life is not worth living until I find a wife or until you find a husband. We've created a culture where romance has transcended to an element of relationships, and that it's all that it is. And if you are not romantic enough, then your marriage or your relationship has reached its culmination and you might as well move on. If you've ever met a couple that have been torn apart by an affair, there's a good chance that one or both have believed the lie that romance is the key to your value. I've had the opportunity of walking through premarital counseling with multiple couples, and no red flag scares me more than when one of the potential spouses believe that this marriage is the key to their value. Because when romance is the key to your value, it only lasts as long as you feel it. And then you will do anything at any cost to rediscover it. You know that this is coming because I mentioned it last night on my Facebook, if you follow me on Facebook, but one of the most cheesetastic songs that has ever been published about the issue and the idea of romance was by the interestingly named Meatloaf. And it says this, in fact, the name says it all. I would do anything for love, but I won't do that. Now, I've always wondered what the that was, because if I'm being real, I know the song, but I've never really listened to the lyrics. And so I assumed that Mr. Loaf was giving an abstract, and it was up to you to decide what the that was. But that's not what it is. You have to actually listen to the lyrics. This is why lyrics matter. Because the one thing that he claims he will never, ever do is love somebody else like he loves her. You are it, baby. I would walk to hell and back for you and nobody else. That must have been really awkward for him to explain to his second wife that he married after this song came out. I don't know what that says about that relationship, but Meatloaf has been married a couple of times now. So apparently, the length that he's willing to go for love is less than he claimed. Because something tells me that he found that after a little while, the romance dissipated, and he found himself wanting more. If it isn't apparent yet, let me make it perfectly clear. Romance is a sneaky idol. It is inviting. It's exhilarating. And in many ways, it's necessary, you know, babies and stuff. But while romance is a good thing, and I've been married for 11 years, and I've been with Jennifer for, I think, 14 now, I'd say that I think the romance is still there. But if that's the only thing that was the basis for our relationship, we'd be in trouble. Because scientifically speaking, scientists say that that romance, especially if it's the basis, the core of your relationship, that's got 36 months tops. If that's it. And if that's the basis for your value, you will find that it will crater. When romance is your God, when you derive your identity, value, and purpose from romance, it becomes dangerous. Tim Keller wrote a book called Counterfeit Gods. I've referred to it a couple of times through this series. And he said this about it. He says that an adulterous attachment to love can lead you to break any promise, rationalize any indiscretion, or betray any other allegiance in order to hold on to it. When we put our hope in romantic love and sacrifice so much for it, you have to ask if this gift from God, this beautiful gift from God, has actually replaced him. And when that happens, the ending is rarely happily ever after. There's a story in the Gospel of John that illustrates the damage that is incurred when you find your value in a relationship. And it's actually one that I often in my life have overlooked because I haven't understood the depths of it. Because you understand, the Gospels were written in the first century, some 2,000 years ago, and certain elements of it are lost on a modern reader. But when we discover the depths of the story, we can so easily see ourselves in it and recognize the beauty of what Jesus offers in its place. So if you have your Bibles, you can turn to John chapter 4. We're going to park there for the rest of our time together. It's going to be on the screens as well, and it's in the Bible app if you like to follow along digitally. But in John chapter 4, Jesus is under fire from religious leaders in the region called Judea, which is where the major biblical cities of Jerusalem and Bethlehem are located. His popularity was growing, and it was making these leaders wary of his presence. So Jesus did them a solid and bounced. He traveled home to Galilee, which is to the north. Now, if you have a working knowledge of first century Israelite geography, which I'm betting I might be the only one here that would, and that's only because of my profession, you probably know that there are two ways to get to Galilee from Judea. You probably don't know this. This is fine. I'm going to explain it. I'm just going to use my hand and pretend it's not Michigan, okay? Where's Hattie at? This is not a dig against Michigan, but so say Judea is down here, and Galilee's up here, there is two ways to get there. You can go straight through and go through the province of Samaria, or you can do what any self-respecting good Jewish person did and avoid Samaria like the plague and go around. To put it in modern context, that'd be like if I'm traveling to get home to New Brunswick, the quickest and most direct route is to go through Quebec. But no self-respecting person who doesn't speak French chooses to travel through Quebec, because they do not like it when English people travel their highways. They like it well enough if you go to Montreal because you spend money there, but there's a good chance, because I've never traveled through Quebec without getting pulled over. I don't know why. So I choose to go the long way. I'll go through Maine, and it'll take 2 extra hours, but it'll be worth it. Both monetarily and for my sanity. And if that is the truth, it was far more significant for people in Jesus' day. For those of you that have never heard of Samaria, you may have heard the term Samaritan. A Samaritan lived in Samaria. Just to give you a concept there, if you've heard of the word Samaritan. Samaritans were very much looked down on by Jewish people, because they shared a common ancestry. But Samaritans diverged from, I guess, mainstream Judaism to develop their own pseudo-religious practices and to marry into other cultures and embrace some of their religious practices. And so in a world where you would separate and divide based on something like that, an entire culture began to diverge, and some heat and anger and hatred began to brew between Samaritans and Jews. And essentially, if you were a good Jewish person, the only way that you would go to Samaria as if you were forced. Perhaps you were in a hurry and it was an emergency and you had to get to Galilee. Then you would go through Samaria. But if it wasn't an absolute emergency, you'd go around. It's just what you would do. It was just the common rational thing to do. But Jesus decided to go through Samaria. Jesus wasn't forced, but he felt compelled to go so that he could reveal the depths of God's grace to a woman that he would meet there. And he arrives to a town called Sychar, and he waits outside as his disciples go and buy supplies and food. And in John 4, verse 6, it says that Jesus was tired, and he hung out by a well. And around midday, while the sun was hot and scorching in the midday Middle Eastern sun, the well was deserted, which made sense. In that day, the only way to get water would be to come and retrieve it from a well. They didn't have running water. That wasn't a thing. So they came and they'd get what they need from the well. But they weren't dumb. They'd come to the well in the morning before the sun got too hot. And so they'd come in, and they'd get the water, and they'd go home. And that was the common thing to do. There would always be a crowd of people there to help one another and to make sure that they got home before it got too excruciating outside. But here at noon, you wouldn't expect to find anybody at the well. But Jesus did. Because it was at that moment that Jesus encountered a woman from the town that came to draw water from the well. And verse 7 tells us, a woman from Samaria came to get some water, and Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" And the Samaritan woman was surprised and says to her, "You are a Jew and I am a Samaritan. How can you ask me for a drink?" She said this because Jews don't have anything to do with Samaritans. And Jesus answered her and says, "You do not know what God's gift is. And you do not know who is asking for a drink. If you did, you would ask him, and he would give you living water." Jesus is confusing this poor woman. And Jesus kind of did that from time to time. He kind of intentionally confused to try to just get people to wrap their mind around a bigger concept. This woman is clearly thinking physical water and knowing how hard it is to get the water and then to carry it home. She's hearing living water, which if you were here a few weeks ago, you may remember that living water meant rivers or rushing streams, something that in an arid area of Samaria, they wouldn't have rushing water. So the idea of living water is an amazing dream that this woman would have. You're telling me I wouldn't have to go to a well to get water? I could just have a stream of living water? She's confused, and Jesus actually reiterates the metaphor, but she's still not getting it. And then Jesus does something curious, something unexpected. But I think it's something that he does so that she could finally get the spiritual implication that he's going for. And in verse 16, he told her, "Go, get your husband and come back." Verse 17, she replies, "I have no husband." And then Jesus said to her, "You are right when you say you have no husband. The fact is you've had five husbands, and the man you live with now is not your husband. So what you've said is very true." Now, this is kind of a weird thing for us to read. There are elements, and it's okay to admit. It's not like you're admitting to some kind of sin to read something from the Bible and say, "Well, that was weird. Why would Jesus do that? That's super uncomfortable." And don't get me wrong, that was an uncomfortable thing to hear for this woman. Jesus is addressing an elephant in the room. He has, in two short sentences, exposed a very significant source of shame that existed in this woman's life. And it probably had for years. And he revealed something that she hated about herself, something that probably ate her up inside. He described the mess of her life in two short sentences. But he didn't do it to embarrass her. There was something else going on. You see, Jesus understood that if she was going to experience his love and his grace, that they had to put everything out on the table. And for us to understand the big picture of what Jesus is saying, we've got to dig a little deeper. Because my whole life, I've looked at this story as if there's something wrong with this woman. Like she was the Kim Kardashian of first century Israel. That she was kind of I don't know if you're older, maybe Elizabeth Taylor, for those that may not know anything about Kim Kardashian. Just so we're all on the same page, maybe middle-aged people, maybe you're thinking Jennifer Lopez, all right? Something for everybody, you understand. Somebody that bounces from relationship to relationship to relationship, somebody that can't commit, somebody that can't stay married, maybe you're thinking somebody that can't stay faithful, they can't get their life together. And that's what we think of when we think of this woman that is at the well. But to understand what's happening here, you have to understand ancient Middle Eastern culture. You see, women had no rights in the first century practically anywhere. Livestock were often considered to be more valuable and important than women. The phrase women's rights were effectively an oxymoron. And so this woman would have had to have been married, because she was utterly dependent on men for everything in her life. In fact, in this context, this woman's value would have shifted from her father to her husband as the only way it means for protection or importance or significance. In fact, while she was under the care of her father, there were more protection for her father if she were to get hurt than there was for her. So for women in this day, they were forced to derive their value from their relationships, because it was, in fact, the only way to discover value. So it explains why she was married as often as she was, because she had to be. If she had no husband, there was no way to work to get food. There was no way to be protected from thieves or robbers or from being taken advantage of by some unscrupulous person. But that leads me to the question of why so many? We again assume that it's her fault. And honestly, Jesus' audience probably did the same, but for different reasons. Because while we assume that she probably had one of those 24-hour marriages that seemed to be so popular among celebrities, that she would decide that she doesn't want to be married anymore, so that she moves on to the next guy and so on and so forth, again, that misunderstands the world that Jesus lived in. Now, maybe she's had five husbands because they keep dying on her. That would be super unfortunate and a little bit suspicious. But it's unlikely because, I mean, if she was killing her husbands, they probably would have caught on by now. I don't think this was a Black Widow kind of situation. And if she was just super unfortunate, widows were pitied, not ostracized. This woman came to the well at noon, not by accident. The only people that would come to a well in the blistering heat of the noonday sun were the outcasts, were people driven by shame to avoid crowds, to avoid the judging glances of men and women of the town. So the only option was to come to the well when nobody else would show up. You know who would be shamed like that? Not widows. Divorcees. They were derided and devalued. They would be cast out and made to feel worthless. In a culture where women practically had no rights, the only way for that to have happened is if her husband filed for divorce. In first century culture, a man could get a divorce for any reason whatsoever, or none at all. If he was unhappy with his marriage, he could divorce her. If he made her mad, well, guess what? Divorce. If she aged poorly and he was unhappy with that and he wanted to trade her in for a younger model, divorce. She, on the other hand, was not given any avenue for protection or divorce. She would not have been able to choose to end her marriage. And so while our 21st century mindset thinks a certain way, Jesus' audience and John's readers would have seen it a little different. Because instead of it being her fault because she was perhaps a little bit on the loose side or on the promiscuous side or on the flighty side, Jesus' audience would have seen this as her fault because she didn't measure up. She was not a good enough wife. And this woman, who had five husbands, would have been told on multiple occasions that she wasn't good enough, wasn't worth being married to anymore. And so she is at a well by herself in the scorching sun with no one to help her because she was ashamed of what had happened to her. And now she is face to face with Jesus and confronted with her brokenness. And while times have radically changed in the last 2,000 years, thankfully so, though we no longer are forced to derive our values from our relationships, so many of us have been tricked into becoming a slave to this God without realizing it. Men and women alike operate under the understanding that their value and identity only comes from their mate. So we begin a relentless search for love and for romance and therefore value and meaning. and we will put everything on hold. Nothing counts until we have that partner, until we find that someone special. We live for the Jerry Maguire moment when Tom Cruise looks at us and says, I love you. You complete me. Or we long to recapture that feeling for those of us that have been married. We want to have that passion and the emotion that declares their undying love for us again. And until we do, we are incomplete. We have yet to reach our potential. We are half a person. We are somehow less than. And that's the problem with the idol of romance, because when we look to someone other than God to complete us, to define our lives, we find that value to be fleeting. It's futile. Because while we were made for relationship, the relationship we were made for was not our marriage. Our marriage is important. My marriage is important. Our relationships with each other are important. But that was not the relationship we were created for. God created us for relationship with Him. And a relationship with a life partner is beautiful and precious and is a gift. But that gift was never meant to replace a relationship with the giver. Kyle Eidelman says it well when he writes, when you make a relationship with somebody else your God, it will eventually be marked with disappointment and bitterness. Because people will always fail you. When you're deriving your value from somebody else, and you're relying on them to feed you or to fill your thirst, you will always be thirsty for more. And if the source cannot give what you want, what do you do? You may become bitter and disappointed at your significant other, your spouse, or your lack thereof. You may go in search of an alternative source of value and fulfillment. Or you may take out your frustrations on that person to force them to give you what you need. Whatever it is, however this manifests itself in your life, the common core throughout is that you cannot and will not find long-lasting fulfillment and value in somebody else. But Jesus has something better. Because though we are limited in our capacity to love, though we often struggle to show the kind of love that the other person deserves, we will always struggle when we love out of our own reserves. But Jesus promised something unique, something special. When he says in verse 13, he says, anyone who drinks this water will soon become thirsty again. But those who drink the water I give will never be thirsty again. It becomes a fresh, bubbling spring within them, giving them eternal life. When you discover the earth-shattering, never-ending, unconditional love of Jesus, and it bubbles up from within the core of your being, you're no longer having to love out of your own capacity, you're loving out of His. And you're loving from the overflow of your relationship with Jesus, and that can never be given or taken away. And it's not a romantic love that is dependent on your emotions. It is a love that is self-sacrificing. It is a love that is life-giving. It is unconditional, and it is never-ending. But if you aim to find your value and your significance in romance, it may be alluring, but it will always fall short. And Jesus looks at us as he looked at the woman, and he longed for her to discover that she was enough. That his love for her was enough. That it didn't matter about her relationship status and how many times she had been told that she's insufficient. All he saw was a woman of value when an entire society saw somebody not worth looking at. And it was in that encounter that changed her life. When she discovered the value that God had for her and the depths of the love that God had for her, what used to be a source of shame, what used to be something that she would go to any lengths to hide, suddenly in verse 28, you see that this woman, because of the grace she encountered, did a complete 180. It says that the woman left her water jar and went back to town, and she said to the people, "Come and see the man, a man who told me everything I've ever done. Could this be the Messiah?" And the people came out of the town and made their way to Jesus. What had been a source of shame and pain and hurt before Jesus became her example to others that Jesus was who he said he was. She found her significance and her value in something far greater than romance. She found Jesus and encountered his love, and it changed everything. So instead of hiding, she now declares, "Come and see." Because Jesus, not romance, had become her God. And the hope that we have today, and I invite the worship team to come up at this time, the hope that I have for you today is, it is not that, it's not that you'd somehow doubt your relationships, because that's never the point of this. Our romantic relationships, our marriages, our significant others are important, and they play an important role in what God is giving to us and the gift that God is offering. But the challenge that we face is to orient our lives in such a way that we can love out of the overflow of what we receive from God. Because when you encounter him in that way, when you meet him face to face, you discover a capacity to love beyond anything that you would ever recognize before. And when you understand your value in context of who he says you are, suddenly you're not looking to somebody else to tell you that you're enough. That your value doesn't rise and fall on the amount of attention you may receive from them. But you are freed to be who God calls you to be and to love as God calls you to love. Because you have found your freedom in Christ, and you have found your significance in Jesus, and you have found your love in him. And as Jesus promised, it becomes like a spring of living water that wells up from inside you. And then you can love out of overflow instead of out of nothing. So this morning, we're going to close with a song. And maybe you find yourself feeling an awful lot like this woman, feeling like you are searching for significance and value, and maybe you've been looking like her, and you've looked to one and two and three and maybe even four or five or more people trying to find the affirmation that you so badly want, but you've somehow found yourself lacking. Maybe you've been told that you're lacking. Maybe you've been married for 30 years, but you still feel like there's something missing. Maybe you don't feel the spark anymore and you're looking somewhere else. Maybe it's a draw to an affair. Maybe it's a draw to some kind of replacement of that in your life. But Jesus is inviting us to reorient around him and to come to him as we are and to discover the beauty that can be found in brokenness, the beauty that only God can bring. So I don't know where you are this morning. I don't know where your head is at. But I do know that when you encounter the love and compassion of Jesus, it changes you. It frees you. And that you can be free this morning. If